there, folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, Director Emeritus of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, your host and fellow learner, Dr. Brian Gurman, Assistant Professor of Theology and current Director of the Bible Institute. Dr. Seleska has had a long career as a parish pastor, college and seminary professor, and he's known for highlighting how central Christ is throughout the entire Bible, both Old and New Testaments. So it's an honor to hear from him again today about the book of 1 Samuel, and I believe we're now on chapter 25.
We are on chapter 25, and before we get into that, let's go back and review a little bit some of the things which we talked about last time, and perhaps supplement them with another fact or two that we failed to talk about last time. But you'll recall, that is, our listeners will recall, that we had found David in the cave of Engedi. And I'm pronouncing these, I hasten to repeat, often enough so that the people listening will know, the pronunciations come from the King James, which is, of course, how God himself pronounces them. And so I'd like them to become familiar with it so they'll know about the voice of the Lord when they hear it. Anyway, he was in the cave of Engedi and taking refuge, I suppose. Still, Saul was after him and came after him then with quite a big army. So much so that I'm sure David must have feared for his very life. And we'll find that he, no matter what Saul says to him, will eventually believe that he will have to avoid Saul at all costs. Because I think it's verse 1 of chapter 27, if I'm not mistaken, where David says, I now am persuaded that I'm going to lose my life with Saul after me. Is that correct?
That's right.
What does
it
say?
Nothing, He says that now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. And Saul will despair of seeking me.
Right. So he just recognized that he could not trust Saul's promises. Saul would make a promise, and of course he would break them almost immediately, which had happened here. So Saul was now after him. David gets into this cave, and Saul comes to the area and himself goes into the cave to relieve himself. We discussed that last time. And I had to conclude, because of the fact that David is able to, quote, sneak up on him and tear a part of his garment off, or cut a part of his garment off, his robe, that he must have been asleep. And that's one of the understandings from that word there. There are others, and you can talk about those among yourselves as you want to. We have discussed them at length last time. But now then, once Saul left the cave, David waited for a while and then went out and shouted after him. Again, he wants to assure Saul that he is not after him. And if you go down there then to verses 5 and following, where David speaks to Saul, and he says to him, but I think it's verse 5, though, also mentions this, that David's heart smote him in the King James. His conscience bothered him because he had, the cause of that is that he had torn or cut this piece of the robe of Saul, sort of defiled, I suppose he thought, the king, the anointed one. I take this to mean he recognized Saul as king, that God had anointed him. Perhaps he also, in his own right, would want to be able to hopefully persuade other people to treat him as God's anointed in the same way that he now here treats Saul. But it's interesting that he recognized this anointed idea that when God anoints a man king, he should be accorded the recognition that he deserves under those circumstances. I think it's a good lesson for us, by the way. When a person is elected for different reasons here in the United States, not quite like the kingship in Israel, but at the same time, we owe him honor. The New Testament, in fact, encourages us to honor the king, to recognize the leaders, really, to acclaim them and their leadership over us. We fail, I think, for the most part to do it, although we do have prayers in church for the leaders of our country, not only for our synod and for our district, but also for the country itself, but prayers for them, even though we may disagree, sometimes very heartily, with what they, with the actions they take in relation to, of course, their service to the people. But we know, we also know that, and now I'm going to have to help you, need some help on this, that he puts down one and sets up another, God. So we should recognize that he's the one who takes the leadership from one and gives it to another. That's, I think that's Psalm 75. I'm going to guess verse 7, but I'm not real sure about that. But I know that there is that verse which says he puts down one and sets up another, so that we, as we read and meditate on the Psalms, should recognize that these people who are over us need to be honored as such, because God is not absent from what takes place in these elections that we hold, even though, like that, is it Proverbs? Proverbs 16, I think, where the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole determination is of the Lord. So it's the Lord behind all that. We cast our votes, but in the final analysis, the Lord isn't absent from the results of an election. Well, we, I think, ought to take David as an example here for our understanding of those who have been placed over us, and in that sense, by the Lord himself. Is that not right?
Yeah, no, Psalm 75, verse 7 is the putting down one and raising up of another.
Putting down one, and there's another one in Daniel, I think, chapter 2 in Daniel, where it says the same thing about kings. He puts one king in place and takes another down.
Right.
And we need to recognize that. So there are a number of other instances probably in Scripture where we could use as examples for our understanding of leadership in the world. Without these leaders, of course, it'd be complete chaos. So we have to have rules and regulations as they are established by, again, the rightfully selected people. And it makes for good government. It makes for a good understanding of how to live in this world. Nevertheless, David would not undermine the authority of Saul, who had been anointed king. And he has it seems he has qualms of conscience here, too, from this little act. I think I did mention last time, but it's interesting how he had deadened his conscience from this point until 2 Samuel chapter 11, where he doesn't seem to have any compunctions at all about sending this message to Job about Uriah the Hittite, the husband of Bathsheba, that he should pull back, put Uriah in the front lines, pull back so that Uriah would be put to death, would die in the battle. I mean, it doesn't seem to bother him at all. And as a matter of fact, when the report comes back, when the report comes back that the Israelites had been defeated and terms of the strategy were that he was to go close to the wall and put Uriah in the front lines, and then Uriah would, of course, lose his life in the battle. Well, interestingly, the servant comes back to explain to David that they had lost the battle, and David is somewhat incensed, I think probably genuinely incensed, and he suggests, didn't Job know about that event of, is it Abimelech, I think, where the widow or woman drops the millstone on his head and he dies. Didn't he know about that? He shouldn't have gotten so close. Then the servant says, Uriah the Hittite is dead. Oh, that makes it a little better. Now, what kind of man is that who here didn't want to tear off a part of the garment of Saul, and in the same way, when he wants to cover up this horrible sin, does so with the murder of Uriah, and doesn't seem to think anything of it? We'll go into that in a little more detail when we get there in 2 Samuel. But to me, that does say something about any human being, that any of us is capable of that. It's really is a warning that if you let the seed of sin grow, it eventually does take over your entire thought process. And David seems to have had no guilt feelings at all about what he had done until Nathan comes. And then we hear a different story. Then all of a sudden it all began to dawn on him. I'm sure it was sort of boiling and broiling underneath, because he does suggest, "When I kept silence, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. For day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. My moisture is turned into the drought of summer." He really was feeling the effects underneath. I guess we would say subconsciously. But boy, when the word came and cut through and exposed him for what he had done, it really did affect him for the rest of his life. "My sin is ever before me," he said. He didn't forget that. Yeah. God did, but he didn't. So we see that kind of a person here initially. He was really, in a sense, pure in thought and understanding of who he was and what he represented. At the same time, he knew himself had already been anointed, even though he hadn't taken the external trappings of the kingdom. He had already been anointed king. So then he exposes Saul also by showing him this piece of garment. And then we have that whole discourse that goes on. We discussed that last time between Saul and David. And Saul finally comes to the conclusion that David, of course, should be judged more righteous than he. And then he has that little statement at the end, which I think is very interesting also. He wants David to promise that when he becomes king, which he knew would happen. So I think that word was out, and I'll say the same thing when we get into this next chapter with Nabal and Abigail, that there was a word around, and that is a word against which Nabal, I think, was sinning also when he refused David's men. But we'll get to that in a moment. But he says, "Don't wipe out my name." Now, I wish I could think of the Psalm. 49? Psalm 49, maybe verse 11. But I'm just a sort of a guess. But it's in this one where their inward thought is that their land shall continue forever. They call their lands after their own names. He wanted recognition of some sort in the future, like... He wants a legacy. You know, we have talk about the presidents all want some sort of legacy. I always think to myself, who cares? Once you're dead, you know, who cares what people might have said or thought about you, how nice you were? You're dead. But I don't know if that's right. It's somewhere in there.
Yeah, you're right. Graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they called lands by their own names.
Yeah. They think this is all going to continue, and they want the recognition. They want a legacy to be left of who they are. And to me, that's very interesting, because it says something about us, that it's all about. It says something about the secular world, I guess, especially not so much about Christians who know what the legacy is in the final analysis, but it says something. This is all they've got. And if I'm not remembered in some special way by calling the land after my own name, my house, and so forth, my legacy, then who am I? And who will I be? I'm a nobody and a nothing, which is, of course, true. And you'll wish it to be even more so true when finally he says, "Depart from me," when people are there saying, didn't we prophesy in your name, and didn't we do miracles in your name, and didn't we proclaim? And he'll say, "I never knew you." They're standing in front of the one parading their own good works, which is essentially what what they're doing when they're trying somehow to maintain a legacy for the rest of the world to know. Not going to be. Anyway, that really sort of takes us to the end of the chapter and into the next chapter, which we need to get into, which is a very interesting one. Because we mentioned last time already, verse 1, about the fact that Samuel died and they mourned for him. But it says that David left. Now, I don't know if he was there at the mourning. I don't know if he might at that point still have ventured. Saul may have left, made his promise, and it may all have seemed okay to David at that point. although I'm not real sure anyway, it does say that he left. He's still under the assumption that this is not a safe world in which to live while Saul is after him, and he knows that's still going to happen, I guess, simply because of Saul's attitude, I think, and what he had said at the end. Don't destroy my name. Don't destroy my house. But then we have the next verses. It talks about this man, very man of very great wealth, I think of great reputation. 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Those are the terms by which they knew of wealth in those days. The rest we don't even know about. What kind of home he had, and he had servants, obviously. His wife had servants. And she had everything attended to by others in her home. So he was a wealthy man, and he was a well-recognized man. And so it says about her that she was beautiful. Abigail was beautiful, and that she was a woman of understanding. We would say perhaps a wise woman, discreet in all of her behavior. She knew who she was, and she knew she was sort of a humble lady also, it seems to me. We'll find out later. He was the King James uses the word churlish. Hmm. I would say maybe uncivilized.
Harsh and badly behaved.
Yeah, well, okay. Not a good guy. Not a fun guy to...
Well, a fool, I suppose. His name means fool, doesn't it?
Yeah, Naval. It means a fool.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, she calls him that
later on when she's
pleading with David and telling him what about her husband. This is her husband. He lives up to his name, as his reputation is foolish. He's a fool. Naval. I often wonder, just aside here at this point, you know, Psalm 14 and 53, the fool has said in his heart, I wonder, Nabal, that's the word.
That's right.
Nabal has said in his heart, there is no God. So who is this David? You wonder. You wonder if David didn't write that in retrospect, looking back at this event, saying, there he is.
Yeah.
This will show you something about, quotes, people who are like Nabal, who are foolish. And obviously a foolish man doesn't have wisdom. And the real wisdom, of course, we know.
Right.
Christ, the wisdom of God and the power of God. He's the one who gives us understanding about all things, really. So we go on in this account now. and David is there, and he has, well, now 600 men. He hears that Nabal's shearers are doing the shearing in this area. He's been there watching over them. He really has been, as he is described, a wall. A servant later on will describe him that way, that he and his soldiers had been a wall by day and night to protect these shearers of Nabal. Well, all right, so he saw all the sheep and the goats that Nabal had, saw all of that, and he must have recognized David, this is a wealthy man. Mm-hmm. And we need provisions. We need supplies. So he selected 10 men to go talk with Nabal about supplying whatever you will want to give. This is how he says it. Whatever you have to give, whatever it is, we'll be very happy to accept it. So he sends these servants. Tell him, of course, a little bit about our circumstances, what we have done, how we have protected your people, and so forth. Even though I assume we weren't. Obviously, we were not hired to do that, but they did it anyway, and nothing happened. We didn't take anything. We didn't injure anybody, and we saw to it that no one got in and in any way injured your shepherds who were watching the sheep. Could you help us out? Just a very nice plea. He says, do this in my name. Is that verse 5? Five or six.
I just saw that. I'll find it.
Okay. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's five. Yep. Oh. Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name.
In my name. Now, what do you think he means by that? In my name.
Name of the king?
Well.
He's not really the...
Here. But, you know, if we were to jump ahead to where Abigail is doing the pleading, and she enters, and I'm going to have you read that later on from verse 26 on. It's a wonderful little sermon that she preaches. Maybe we should read it here, and it will say something about why he says, in my name.
Okay.
Go ahead, read the whole thing. We need to take a break.
Should we take the break first?
Okay.
And then we'll start with that little sermon?
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll pick it up, Abigail's sermon here on the other side of the break.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Alrighty there, folks. We are back with our study of 1 Samuel 25. This is David and Abigail. We talked a little bit about Abigail's husband, that was Nabal, and now we're going to read this little sermon from Abigail and then go from there. So I think it starts up about verse 24, where Abigail falls at David's feet and says, "On me alone, my lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. Now then, my lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my lord be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my lord a sure house, because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and has appointed you prince over Israel, my lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my lord taking vengeance himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my lord, then remember your servant."
Now,
what a sermon.
Yeah, well, she really does know who he is and what he is going to be. The Lord is going to set you up. It says prince there, but when he comes to rule, King James indicates that he's going to be the ruler. She knows it.
My Lord.
Yeah. And that the Lord
under
is...
Under the Lord.
Under the Lord.
My Lord under the Lord.
Now then,
Psalm 110 almost.
Yes.
The Lord says
to
my Lord.
Yeah, you have the Messiah there.
But that's David speaking to his Lord.
Oh, but this is, consider this now. And I mentioned it earlier with Nabal. It says that who is David? When the men come, the 10 men come, and Nabal says, they come into the name of David. They say, who is David, and who is David's son, or who is the son of Jesse?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if this is in defiance. I know who you are. I don't care who you are, and I don't care if you're David, and I don't care if people are saying you're going to be the ruler. He's the great man. Nabal is the great one. He's the rich one. You're a beggar. Here you are begging me for stuff. I'm not going to give you anything. I don't. One servant runs away today as another, and who knows who they are and where they come from. It's as almost as if he's defying what he knows. Because if his wife knows this, be assured he knows it. And so we have her giving this remarkable little sermon about David, what she believes, and how he was to have pity and mercy on her, which he could as ruler, but he had to be ruler. Who is he right now? He's a fugitive. He's a vagabond and a wanderer. Okay, now we'll jump back again, and we'll lead up to this, where then, of course, the men return to David after they've heard from Nabal that he refuses everything. And in verse 13, I'm sure it's verse 13, where David says, "Gird on your swords." They've right. got swords now. This is kind of an army. I don't know how much of an army, but they have swords. And gird on your swords. And then he goes on to exclaim, if you jump to verse 22, what he had decided in his heart, not a male is going to be left. We discussed that last time. Not one male is going to be left in this man's household. And I want to make this statement about David at this point. He has almost lost control. In other words, he's furious because he's been rejected. It's evident that David does have a temper, and I wonder if he didn't show that evidence that when he said, "Who is this who's defying the Lord?" when to Goliath. "Who is this guy that defies the Lord of armies, our Lord? I mean, I'll go out. Nobody else will. I'll go." It's just almost like a rash act on his part. And in a certain sense, I think this was a rash decision on his part, just to wipe out all these people because he's been refused.
Right.
We've been working for him. We've been with him. We've been taking care of his shepherds. And now look at how we've been rebuffed by this no good. Let's go get him. And of course, I think he might have done something about which he would have been terribly sorry later on in his life, shed this blood of people who didn't really deserve it. But when then one of the servants, of course, doesn't go back and try to persuade Nabal, because the servant himself says, "You can't persuade this guy. He's just a no good. He's right. a son of Belial." Now, that's what the King James says. I don't know.
I'll find it.
Okay. Well, it'll be about 14, 15, 16, around in there, when the servant came back and explained it to her. And then she, of course, immediately sets off to provide food. She gets, I don't know where she got them, 200 loaves of bread and two wineskins, we might say barrels of wine, perhaps, to assuage the thirst of these. She knows there's a great deal of them. I don't know if she knows that there are 600, but there are 600 who have to be fed and who have to drink. And wine, in this case, of course, was a standard beverage. And then there were 200 fig cakes, and there were 100 clusters of raisins, and quite a bit of food. Some corn, I don't know, not corn flakes, but they were, I don't know how are they, how do you? How,
it looks like a parched corn.
Parched corn, that's what it says in the King James. I don't know what that is, but edible.
Clusters of raisins?
Yeah.
Cakes
yeah.
of figs?
Yeah. Figs, yeah, all that. She's got it ready, and she then walks behind the men, and the supplies are ahead. She puts it all on the mules, the donkeys, and then she, of course, rides in. And as soon as she comes to David, she, of course, falls off or jumps off the donkey and then bows in front of him and begins to exclaim and to indicate to him, of course, that she didn't know any of this beforehand, and if she had, of course, she obviously would have taken note of it and done something about it, but she didn't know. So the whole thing has transpired. We've read her little sermon, and it's a remarkable sermon when you get right down to it.
It really
bound
is.
In the bundle of life. That's an interesting statement that she makes. It's almost as if there's only one life. We know who that is, and it's like his life is tied up in this life. This is the only life. She recognized that life. As apart from her husband, who didn't recognize it at all. He's on the outside looking in. She's on the inside looking out. And that's, again, in that whole chunk of verses,
right.
verse 30.
Right, yeah, 24 to 31.
Yeah.
Right. Bound in the bundle of the living.
Yeah.
In the care of the Lord your God.
Yeah. The Lord is doing, in other words, he's bound into that life. It's a remarkable statement also that she comes up with. She's truly a Christian lady. Now then, we probably are getting near to the end, but here I've got a few things to mention before we close this up. But then, of course, David accepts it. He said, I've accepted it. And then I think it's verse 34 when he says, mm-hmm. You got to believe that what I was going to do, you've persuaded me not to do, and you've really kind of prevented me from having done things that I would have great remorse about later on, shedding innocent blood. Is that verse 34?
Yes, and from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand.
Yeah, that whole thing really persuaded him. All of a sudden, he realized he listened to her. And he must have admired what this lady said. She must have really kind of converted him to her way of thinking and reminded him of who he was. And the power which he had, which he shouldn't misuse or abuse, was very important. So okay, he goes back, and she goes back home, and she didn't tell her husband because he was having a big party. He was drunk, having a good time. He was happy. She said nothing to him about what she had done. But the next morning, interestingly, I assume we'll say he was having a gigantic hangover. And then she told him. I mean, it wasn't bad enough to wake up feeling like this, but to have your wife tell you what she had done, as opposed to, you know, his rebuke of David's men. You can't imagine how this man must have felt. Well, it says his heart turned to stone in the King James.
Yeah, became as stone.
It became
his heart,
as stone.
Heart died within him, and he became as a stone.
We would say heart failure? I don't know. Yeah. Coronary? Something of that. 10 days later, he died.
The Lord struck him, and he died.
He died. When David heard it, then he sent a message to her. He must have been really struck by her. Now, you got to remember, David's already married once, Michal, although Saul had given her to Faltai.
That's right.
But he was married once, and he had another wife, Ahinoam. That's the last verse here, I think.
That's right. That's right.
He had another wife. But I don't want to go into all that today. We could perhaps pick it up at that point next time. But she accepted, and she took with her five of her maidens, the King James says, five ladies in waiting, those who took care of her needs. She's a rich woman. She took them along, but he accepted her proposal. He proposed through these servants who came to her. She accepted and became his wife, it says. Very interesting, very, very interesting development. But you have to admire her, I think, and I'm sure David must have. When you go through that little sermon which you read, mm-hmm. And I'm advising our listeners to do that. Start with verse 24 and go through that little sermonette and meditate on what she is saying about David. She knew this. So my guess is that there was word around already, enough that everybody recognized who was going to be the next king. But I think perhaps all of them also recognized the legitimacy of Saul's being anointed king and that he was still the king. And he was so until God dealt with him as he finally would in that last chapter. That probably takes us enough. We shouldn't really go into the next chapter.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I did remember hearing once that last wife you mentioned, the Ahinoam?
Yeah, of Jezreel.
Of Jezreel, that was possibly Saul's wife? Maybe we can get into another time? maybe into the next time. Tune in next time.
Yes, that's true. And it is very puzzling. And I don't understand it either. And my guess is if you go through the commentaries, I will do that before next time, you will find that the commentators are in disagreement about how to understand that this might have been another Ahinoam. But it's of Jezreel. It identifies her further. Well, we'll look at it next time because it's a very interesting development. And I don't know how to take it, but remember who she was. If she was Saul's wife, she was a somebody.
That's right.
What do you do with a former king's wife? I mean, if you just try to somehow work through, where would she go? How would she still be recognized? She certainly is somebody.
Right.
When she is the king's wife, she's queen. Does she lose? Obviously, she loses the title in the sense of the present.
Former first lady.
Former first lady, something. But then, is that enough? And maybe David recognizes that.
We'll have to start next time with sorting some of this out.
Yeah. Is she just a figurehead? I mean, you can see it that way. She's just a figurehead. She's right there, and he wants to accord her that acclaim that she deserves. We don't know anything about her. We don't know what kind of woman she was. We know about Abigail. Right. But we don't know about anything. We know a little bit about Michael.
That's true.
And she will finally be restored to David.
Right.
And then her present husband is going along. He loves her, and he's going to walk along as she's taken, weeping. So, boy, that's another story. Yeah. And then we find out later about her, too.
Well, I look forward to sorting some of those things out with you
next
week.
We'll
have to look into it then. So that is all the time we have for this session of Christ in Every Word. But please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they too can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman here today with Dr. John Seleska, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.